So, what are we doing here this summer at the Summer Forum? It's been announced a little bit, but I'm going to go over kind of a big picture, 30,000 foot overview of what we'll be aiming for this summer. You can see on the slide here, the title of our forum is Faith Share, 10 weeks, that's what we have over the course of the summer, to grow your gospel readiness. To grow your gospel readiness. So here's our aim: to inspire and equip one another for greater participation and effectiveness in local personal evangelism. So two words here, very important. The first one is inspire. My prayer is that through our times together this summer, myself, I'll be teaching some. We have other teachers that will be teaching as well. That the content and the tone and everything that we do would inspire us to greater participation and effectiveness in evangelism. And the other piece that I hope we achieve this summer is that we will equip one another in various ways. And that will happen throughout the summer for this. In other words, we're both calling us as a church to greater participation in local personal evangelism. And we hope that by drawing attention to this theme, it will inspire us and equip us to do so with greater confidence. So that's what the summer is all about. A kind of theme verse, if you want to think about it that way, for us this summer is 1 Peter 3:15. There, Peter says, "In your hearts, honor Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared or ready to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you. And do it with gentleness and respect." So we'll come back to features of this text in the weeks to come. But here, just to note, we want to be ready. And not only in what we might call apologetic kinds of contexts. The word here is defense, where we get our word apologetics from, but I mean this more broadly. For us to be ready to communicate, to proclaim, to share, to tell of the reason for the hope that is in us, to tell of the gospel in any context, and especially in personal engagement with the people in your life. So that's our aim. Why are we focusing on this? Why are we doing this? Well, there are some good biblical answers. One would be we're doing this for the glory of God. We're focusing on this aspect of the scriptures for the glory of God and his call on our life. So Paul says in 1 Corinthians 10:31, whether you eat or drink or, and then he just, whatever you do, which would certainly include our personal evangelism. Whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. So that's one reason. Another reason, out of love for the lost. Paul in 1 Thessalonians 2:8 says this, because we loved you so much, we were delighted to share with you not only the gospel of God, but our lives as well. So here Paul is writing back to the Thessalonians, kind of reflecting on the first time he came to them. And so out of love for the Thessalonians who were lost, Paul shared with them the gospel of God. And that's the emphasis that we're focusing on today and in the weeks to come, though we're not ignoring sharing our lives with you as well. In fact, that will become a key component of effective evangelism for us in the weeks to come. But here, another reason for why we're focusing on this theme is out of love for the lost. A third reason is in obedience to Jesus. Famously, Matthew 28:19, go therefore and make disciples of all nations. Now this command is broader and encompasses more than just initial tellings of the gospel. to friends, neighbors, strangers, but it doesn't mean less than that. That is a necessary component to making disciples of all nations. So we're also focusing on this and calling us to this in obedience to Jesus. And then finally, this one's a little bit more directed to now, our kind of time and place. Another reason why I'm focusing on this topic is so that we might gain greater clarity on the gospel. One of the things I'm going to demonstrate for you today is that there is actually some confusion when it comes to answering the question, what is the gospel? And so in order to be effective evangelists, sharers, tellers of the gospel, we need to know and understand what the gospel is. And so that's what we'll be doing today. Paul says in Galatians 2:5, so that the truth of the gospel might be preserved for you. In every generation, the gospel has to be understood clearly and re-articulated clearly, communicated clearly, preserved for the sake of the health of the church and the saving of the nations. So those are four reasons. There are others, but those are the four I've given for why we're focusing on this theme this summer. How are we going to go about doing this? Well, the first thing we're going to do before we get into the topic, the specific topic for each morning, is we're going to spend some time around our tables praying for non-believers in our lives. So the first thing we're going to do today, once I finish giving this big picture overview, is we're going to go to our tables just for a couple minutes. And I want you to right now be thinking of one non-believer that you know in your life. And what we're going to do week in and week out is we're going to pray for them by name. And that's how we're going to begin. This is one way, in fact, one of the chief ways we get this inspiration and motivation to be sharing the gospel is when we have real names and faces in our minds of people who need to hear it. And we believe that God is sovereign in the saving of sinners, and so that's why we pray for them. So we'll begin each week by doing that. Also, throughout the summer, obviously we'll be teaching on important questions. And especially the bulk of the summer will be given over to addressing specific objections to the Christian faith. And the main flyer that we announced to the church has kind of the list of all those topics. You've seen that. The bulk of the summer will be giving attention to those questions and objections and answering them in order to help equip all of us to have at least something to say. We're not going to be able to exhaust everything that needs to be said for you on all of these questions or objections, but we will be able to say some good and helpful things, and we want you to be able to absorb those and then take those with you so that if you're in the context of a conversation and someone asks you a question, you don't feel immediately the need to kind of silence up, as it were. I don't know what to say. I'm going to stop that conversation. Rather, you'll have at least something to say and continue the conversation. So we'll be dealing with some of those questions. Also, there will be various forms of dialogue throughout the summer. There will be Q&A opportunities. There will be interviews. There will be table discussions, etc. For example, today, I'm going to leave about 7 minutes or so at the end of our time for just a general Q&A on the topic that we're addressing today. Other times, I may have another individual up here that I will interview and go back and forth on that particular topic. At other times, we may have questions to kind of motivate and generate some conversation that we want you to have around your tables on the topic that we've addressed. So it's going to take lots of different forms. But this is not going to be merely lecture, and we're not preaching an expositional sermon, but what we're doing is having various forms of participation throughout the summer. And I think that will help us in our aim. We'll also have weekly take-home summary cards on the topic for each week. So as you came in, you probably saw this one on the table. If you don't have this, you can pick it up on your way out. It's just going to give the main question that each Sunday is addressing, and then it's going to give the summary answer to that question on the back. So today's is the main question is, what is the gospel? We're going to get into that together in just a moment. And then there's an answer that I've provided for you on the back, something that you can just have in your wallet, in your purse, in your pocket. You can remind yourself of it regularly, and then it just becomes a part of you and easy to share, remember, and to share. So we'll have those each week as well. And then finally, we'll have recommended books available for purchase right outside here at the end of each session. So today, I've got a number of books. I think that there's five here that I'm going to recommend on this particular topic that I'm addressing today. One of them will be available for purchase today. The other ones didn't quite come in time, but they will be available in subsequent weeks. But these are just resources that we trust and value as leaders at College Church, and we want to recommend them to you on these issues and topics. So we'll recommend those as well. And here at this side, like where the treats are and all that kind of stuff, the coffee, they can only accept cash or check. So just as you plan ahead for the future to purchase a book, cash or check here, but if you want to purchase the book and you don't have cash or check, just a card, you can take the book over to our book stall right outside the sanctuary and you can pay credit card over there. So, number of things on the how we're going to achieve our aim this summer. So, here's our topic today, week one, understanding the gospel, its meaning and importance. But like I mentioned, we're actually going to begin each week in prayer for non-believers. So that's what we're going to do now. Just take a couple minutes around your tables. Think of, in your mind, or write down, if that helps, a name of a non-believer that you know and that you want to pray for. And in 2 minutes, I'll call us back and we'll get into this topic. Okay? Go right ahead. Okay. I'll draw you back here. Well, thank you for doing that. And my hope and prayer is that even in the times when we're praying together for these non-believers, love is increasing in your hearts for them. Paul said of his unbelieving Jewish brothers and sisters in Romans 10 that my heart's desire and prayer to God for them is that they might be saved. And so we will begin that way each week. Okay, so in order to be effective evangelists, tellers of the gospel, communicators of the gospel, we must first have a firm grasp on what the gospel is. And that's what our task is this morning. So, understanding the gospel. There is, in my opinion, quite a bit of confusion surrounding the gospel, and I'm going to demonstrate that to you in two ways. First, a few statistics, and then also I'm going to give to you some quotes from evangelical leaders, whether they are evangelical biblical scholars, whether they are pastors, whether they're leaders in another way, shape, or form, journalists, editors, etc. So first, we'll look at some statistics. A new survey conducted in 2020 by the Cultural Resource Center at Arizona Christian University found that a majority of Americans, and that's 52%, who identify as Christian, adopt a, quote, works-oriented means to salvation, that is, acceptance with God. So 52% of Americans who identify as Christian adopt a works-oriented means to salvation. Now, the more staggering number in my mind is that 41% identified as evangelical, 70% Catholic. Now, the Catholic one probably doesn't surprise you as much, but the evangelical percentage should be surprising. indeed alarming. 49, that same survey, 49% of Americans in general believe they have a personal responsibility in appropriate situations to share their religious beliefs with people who possess different religious beliefs. That perhaps isn't as surprising to you, but it's another reminder of where we are culturally. To share the truth of Christianity with someone is likely to be seen as, what's the word for it? Over aggressive, intolerant, right? One of our main beliefs in our culture is inclusion, and a particular definition of inclusion, which generally doesn't mean we push our beliefs onto another person. At least that's how they conceive of it. We don't conceive of it that way, but a number of people don't believe we should share our beliefs with others in the attempt to persuade them that what we're sharing is true and to get them to align with what we're sharing. And then according to a 2018 Pew study, Pew Research study, this is more specific to our location here, 16% of those within the Chicago metro area, Chicagoland, identify as evangelical, contrasted with 34% Catholic. So just in our area, 16% identify as evangelical. Now, put that up with the first statistic where we said a number of, namely 41% of evangelicals, according to that study, adopts a works-oriented approach to salvation, and we have great confusion on the gospel, is my takeaway from that. Now, surveys, as we all know, you have to be careful with them, and they don't all kind of have the same parameters and methodology, and there are lots of factors that get to these numbers. But even if these numbers need to be adjusted to some degree, which I'm sure they do, it's still a pretty staggering picture, I think. And so there's great opportunity before us as well for the gospel right here in Chicagoland. Now here's some quotes from evangelical leaders. The gospel itself refers to the proclamation that Jesus, the crucified and risen Messiah, is the one true and only Lord of the world. So there's a quote. The gospel itself. Here's another one. The good news is that God's face will always be turned toward you, regardless of what you have done, where you have been, or how many mistakes you've made. He loves you and is turned in your direction, looking for you. Next one. Here's the gospel in a phrase. Because Christ died for us, those who trust in him may know their guilt has been pardoned once and for all. What will we have to say before the bar of God's judgment? Only one thing. Christ died in my place. That's the gospel. There's a few more. The gospel is not a system of how people get saved. The announcement of the gospel results in people getting saved, but the gospel itself, strictly speaking, is the narrative proclamation of King Jesus. The gospel, this next one, is the proclamation of Jesus in two senses. First, it is the proclamation announced by Jesus, that is, the arrival of God's realm of possibility, his kingdom, in the midst of human structures of possibility. But it is also the proclamation about Jesus, that is, the good news that in dying and rising, Jesus has made the kingdom he proclaimed available to us. Lastly, God is the gospel. Until the gospel events of Good Friday and Easter and the gospel promises of justification and eternal life lead you to behold and embrace God Himself as your highest joy, you have not embraced the gospel of God. So, from all those quotes, and I could have just continued to enumerate these, there's a lot of things in these quotes, right? Many of which we would simply say, yes, amen, that's good. Themes of Jesus's life and death and resurrection are in some of these, not in others. Themes of the kingdom are in some of these, not of the others. Themes of God as the highest good of the gospel, or as one at least, and not the others, at least explicitly articulated, and more. So there's overlap between these definitions of the gospel, but there's also significant differences in these definitions of the gospel. So what accounts for this diversity of definitions? I think it's because there are different approaches to defining the gospel. In other words, where you begin determines to some extent where you end. How you go about answering the question, what is the gospel, determines, in some sense, the content of that definition. And so as I've read the literature and talked to numerous people, I've discerned at least these four. There are others, but these four will be enough for us to get our minds around this morning. These four approaches to defining the gospel. There's the word study approach. There's what I call a systematic approach. There's a narratival approach, the story approach. And then there's the big word here, teleological approach. Don't worry, it just means ultimate purpose or ultimate goal. So, let's take a look at these four approaches in a little bit more detail. The word study approach is what it sounds like. We take a look at the word for gospel. And the word gospel comes from the Greek word euangelion, means good news. And that noun occurs 76 times in the New Testament. And I'm just restricting ourselves to the noun here. If we were to include the verb euangelizo, to preach good news, then we'd add another 50-some uses in the New Testament alone, plus the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament. But here we're looking at just the noun gospel. Euangelion means good news. So in this approach, what happens is you start with identifying the word, and then you search the New Testament, all those uses of the word, and you start taking notes and seeing what's said in and around each word, and then you kind of look, step back and look at the results, and you try to synthesize it into a definition, and that's the gospel. That's the word study approach. Here's a quote from William Tyndale, who says, "Euangelion, what we call the gospel, is a Greek word signifying good, merry, glad, and joyful news." This isn't specific yet to the New Testament. This is just what the word means, used in lots of different contexts, and that's true. It makes a man's heart glad and makes him sing, dance, and leap for joy. That's a little bit of poetic license there, but you get the picture. Okay, it's gospel is good news. Whatever the content is, it's good for the people hearing it. It's a good message. It's good news. Now, when you take this approach and you apply it in the New Testament, here's a kind of summary definition that you might get, and it comes from D.A. Carson in a very good essay that I'll recommend to you at the end. He says this, "The gospel word group in the New Testament means the good news of what God has done supremely in Jesus, including his coming, death, and resurrection, and then as a kind of catch-all here, all that he does that flows from this sacrifice." So you do the word study approach, tabulate all the uses of gospel, synthesize them together, and you get a definition like this. more or less. Here are just some examples textually that Carson and others draw from. 1 Corinthians 15. Now I would remind you, brothers, of the gospel I preached to you. For I delivered to you as of first importance. Notice, the gospel is of first importance for Paul and should be for us as well. I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received. And then here's the content of what he delivered, or in other words, the content of the gospel. That Christ died for our sins in accordance with the scriptures. That he was buried and that he was raised on the third day in accordance with the scriptures. So there's an example of the word gospel in the New Testament where it's definitional. Sometimes the word gospel just shows up quite a bit in order to achieve some other end that Paul is after or another New Testament writer is after. But here he's, in a sense, giving us a definition. And so you can see it's of first importance and it centers on the person of Jesus. And more specifically, it includes his death, burial, and resurrection. And you could even include, this is the fulfillment of what God had planned all along. That's the meaning of in accordance with the scriptures. Okay, or here's another one. This is 2 Timothy 2:8. Remember Jesus Christ, so there's the person again, risen from the dead, there's the raised. Here's a new element, the offspring of David. Come back to that one later. As preached in my gospel. So here's another definition, as it were, of the gospel. The person of Christ, risen from the dead, offspring of David. Important features. And then here's one more. Romans 1:9. And like I said, there are 76 uses of this noun, so these are three. For God is my witness, whom I serve with my spirit in the gospel of his Son. It's just a way of summarizing it very shorthand. The good news concerning the Son of God, Jesus. So that approach, like I said, takes up all the uses of gospel in the New Testament, steps back, synthesizes it all together, and comes up with the definition of the gospel, very similar to what D.A. Carson put here. Okay, that's the word study approach. What is the systematic approach to defining the gospel? Well, here, it's less looking at the word gospel and only those contexts, and instead, it's seeking to summarize what the New Testament writers say about the significance of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection, even if the word, and we might add probably precisely when, the word gospel is not present. We all know this intuitively, right? Someone could be talking about the gospel and not use the word gospel. Nevertheless, what is said is important to defining the gospel. So a word doesn't equal the totality of the concept to which the word points. So in this case, those who follow this approach say, but we, yes, word study approach, that's good, it's needed, absolutely needed, but we also have to think a little bit bigger and broader too, because there are other things that are said in the New Testament that directly relate to the gospel, but the word gospel's not there. So we have to include that, right? That's the rationale for this approach. Or here's how Greg Gilbert puts it in his book, What is the Gospel? Seeking to discern a shared framework of truths around which the apostles and early Christians structured their presentation of the good news of Jesus. So they're after a little bit more expansive definition here that is a, quote, framework of truths. So how does that cash out? Well, in a very familiar presentation of the gospel, I would imagine for most of you, there are four steps. God, man, Christ, and response. This is a systematic way of defining the gospel. First, God. It's answering the question, who made us and to whom are we accountable? It starts with God. We are not wholly independent creatures. We are dependent creatures on a creator. And in order for the gospel to be the gospel, that is a necessary truth that one must understand and then embrace. So it starts with God. Who made us? The living God. And to whom are we accountable? Him. Man. Well, what is our problem? In other words, are we in trouble and why? So this gets at the issue of sin. What we have done with respect to our Creator. And then Christ, what is God's solution to that problem and how has he acted to save us from it? And then the response, how do I, myself, right here, right now, how do I come to be included in that salvation? What makes this good news for me and not just for someone else? So for those who take this approach, especially it's that fourth point that is very important for them. They would argue that you don't have a true proclamation of the gospel if you leave this response element out. For example, if I were to stand up here and say to you the gospel, like one of the quotes before, is the good news that Jesus Christ is Lord, he is the reigning king, God raised him from the dead, and he's making all things new. Those who take this approach would say, I actually have not preached the gospel, even though I have said biblically true things. Do you see what this approach is trying to push us toward? It's that, okay, well, what makes that good news good for me, for individuals, for people? How does someone get into that good news? That's the systematic approach. And then here are just texts, just from Romans 1 to 4, that is commonly used as a framework for this kind of approach. Romans 1, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they didn't honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking, their foolish hearts were darkened. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. So here we begin with God, and we also have the predicament of man. We've sinned. We've exchanged the truth of God for a lie. We've exchanged the glory of God for images resembling ourselves, animals, etc., as Paul says in Romans 1. So Paul begins his exposition of the gospel, you might say, in Romans 1, with the bad news, actually, that there's a God who created us, to whom we are accountable, and because of our sin and rebellion against him, we're actually under his wrath. There's nothing good about that news so far. Nevertheless, they would say that's necessary to a proper articulation of the good news. So then you turn the corner in Romans 3, but now the righteousness of God has been manifested apart from the law. For yes, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, and are now justified by his grace as a gift through the redemption that is in Christ, whom God put forward as a propitiation by his blood. He was delivered up for our trespasses, and he was raised for our justification. So the answer to the problem is Jesus Christ, his person, and his work, as articulated, for example, here. And then finally, what is the response that this news calls for, or how does it become true and appropriated to oneself? Here, the righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ for all who believe, Jew and Gentile. For we hold that one is justified by faith apart from works of the law. And to the one who does not work, but believes in him who justifies the ungodly, his faith is counted as righteous. And we could righteousness, and we could just continue to add texts after text that would say the same thing. So this is the response. So within Romans 1 to 4, we see a kind of presentation of the gospel, if you will, from a systematic approach. That's the second one. The third one, we call a narratival approach. This is where those who embrace defining the gospel this way prefer to begin with the idea that there's a big story. And the Bible presents this story. Here's one example, Scott McKnight. He says, the gospel for the Apostle Paul is the salvation unleashing story of Jesus as the Messiah, Lord, and Son that brings to completion the story of Israel as found in the scriptures of the Old Testament. And he equates the story of Israel with basically the entirety of the Old Testament. So that what you have here is his articulation of the fact that the Bible presents us a story. And it's integral to keep that in mind, that there's a story as the macro structure to which all the individual pieces fit. And we don't understand, they would claim, the individual pieces unless we understand something of the whole of the story. Now, there are a couple different ways. I gave the quote from McKnight, and I'll give you his way of doing it as well. But the traditional way is very familiar to us. Four steps, if you will, or four scenes to this story: creation, fall, redemption, consummation. Most of us, I imagine, have probably heard of that framework before, and it's a good framework. It tells the overall story of the Bible as God presents it to us. Creation, fall, redemption, and consummation. Scott McKnight's unique take on this is that the story of Israel includes within it creation, fall, and even, in some sense, redemption, as it's typified in the promise to Abraham. And then as the history of Israel develops and grows from the historical books and to the prophets as they look forward to the culmination of God's redemption in Jesus the Messiah. But he breaks it down into this way: the story of Israel, and then the story of Jesus, which completes the story of Israel. And then, as a result of that story of Jesus, you have the plan of salvation and the method of persuasion, which then leads you finally to consummation as well. For him, it's important that we don't confuse the gospel itself, which concerns the story of Jesus and who he is and what he's done, with our response to the gospel. See the difference between this approach and the systematic approach? Systematic approach included within it the response as necessary. This approach says the response in a big picture is necessary, but it's technically not part of the gospel. That's what this approach is saying. So here's the way he ends his book. He says, our gospel, and he gives his definition, it's the saving story of Israel now lived out by Jesus, who lived, died, and was buried, was raised, and was exalted to God's right hand, and who is now roaring out the message that someday the kingdom will come in all its glorious fury. So that's his final word at the end of his book on the gospel. You can see that story or that narrative element present in it. One text that he points to as very significant for this is Romans 1:1-4, where Paul says, he identifies himself, Paul, set apart for the gospel of God, which, and that's which is going back here, he promised beforehand through his prophets in the Holy Scriptures, similar to 1 Corinthians 15. So this gospel was promised beforehand, so it's connected very, very integrally with the story of Israel, and that the gospel concerns his son, and then who was descended from David according to the flesh. declared to be the Son of God in power, according to the Spirit of holiness, by his resurrection from the dead, Jesus Christ our Lord. So here in this opening of probably one of the greatest letters ever written, the letter to the Romans, he identifies the gospel as being promised beforehand in the scriptures of Israel, terminating on his son Jesus, who is then described in Israelite terms, first, as a descendant from David. So in his humanity, he is in the line of David. Well, why does that matter? Well, because God made promises to David in the Old Testament that are fulfilled in Jesus. So this is one text, there are others, that he would go to say we have to ground the gospel more explicitly in the story of Israel and less abstractly in God, man, Christ response. So that leads him to a slightly different definition of the gospel, though he believes in all those things. And then finally, we have this teleological approach, this ultimate good or ultimate purpose. This approach defines the gospel with respect to its ultimate purpose. This comes from John Piper in his book, God is the Gospel. So with respect to the ultimate goal of the gospel, the ultimate good that the good news offers, until the gospel events of Good Friday and Easter and the gospel promises of justification and eternal life lead you to behold and embrace God himself as your highest joy, you have not embraced the gospel of God. God himself is the gospel. So that's another addition to some of these definitions that we hadn't quite seen before. And there are texts that lead him to this conclusion, and he points to a couple. First, 1 Peter 3:18, for Christ also suffered once for sins, this is his death, substitutionary death, the righteous for the unrighteous, in order that, note the purpose language here, he might what? Bring us to God. That's one way of articulating it. Or here's Isaiah 40, verse 9. Go on up to a high mountain, O Zion, herald of good news. That's the verb for preach the gospel in the Septuagint here. Lift up your voice with strength, O Jerusalem, herald of good news. Lift it up, fear not. And what's the content of the gospel here? Behold your God. When we come to this all-important text for Piper, he sees it terminating on the glory of Christ, enjoyed, seen for what it really is. And here's 2 Corinthians 3. Even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing. In their case, the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelievers to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. For what we proclaim is not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord. That's what they're proclaiming, the gospel, with ourselves as your servants for Jesus' sake. For God who said it, and I'm putting in the words at creation here, because that's what he's alluding to, let light shine out of darkness. God has shown in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. So, what is the content of the gospel here? It's the glory of Christ, or it's the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ. They go together. So, behold your God, from Isaiah, is behold Jesus. That's the telos, the culmination point of the good news, if you will. And that's what leads him to his definition. So, those are the four approaches. Word study, systematic, narratival, teleological, and they all have so much in common, right? And yet they all have slight differences that lead them to stress or emphasize one thing over another. And this is what I think accounts for, among evangelicals, some of the confusion that we find when we just talk to people and we ask them to tell us what the gospel is, and they kind of like, well, it's this, what's that, it's hemming and hawing, and it's like, what? This is like the center of who we are as evangelicals. We need to have a ready answer for what is the gospel. And so I'm going to advocate approaching it this way. I'm not necessarily disagreeing with everything that we just went through, but I'm just giving my 2 cents on how we can approach it. From 2 angles, kind of a metaphor here, in the air and on the ground. So in the air, this is the city of Chicago, from the air, right? Here's the city of Chicago, on the ground. Looks quite different. Is only one of them Chicago? No. It all has to do with our vantage point, right? Whether we're seeing the whole picture from 30,000 feet in the air, or whether we're seeing the picture street level, as it were. But they're both Chicago. They're both Chicago. Likewise, for the gospel, if we're to think about it from the air, the storyline of the Bible or redemptive history, I think this is a great way to do it. Creation, fall, redemption, consummation. And even including in here the redemption piece, the story of Israel, is important. But basically what we're saying here is the Bible's storyline as a whole gives us the in-the-air picture of the gospel. And we need to know that. That helps us. There are things we can understand about the gospel only by seeing it from that vantage point that we may not be able to see if we're just on the street, so to speak. But surely that's not sufficient, just an aerial understanding. We also need the ground understanding. So when we get to the ground, the street level, what are we seeing? Well, we're seeing the story of Jesus specifically and how it becomes good news for sinners. So we have that kind of systematic approach. God, humanity, Christ, and our response. That's also very good, very helpful. We need to include both. We need to recognize that the gospel is at one and the same time both very simple and profound and can be shared in 30 seconds with someone, and at the same time, massive, indeed cosmic in scope in what God is doing in his world. So we need both. And so I'm offering you a definition. This is the definition that's on your card that you can take with you, and try to just absorb it into your heart and mind. It tries to encapsulate the best of what we just surveyed. Some of this definition comes from Ray Ortlund, and some of it is my modification of his definition, but here's what it is. The gospel is the good news that God, through the perfect life, atoning death, and bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ, rescues all his people, that is, those who repent of their sin and trust in him. That's how you become part of his people. And what does it rescue his people from? His wrath and the dominion of sin into peace with him and everlasting joy in his presence. That's an allusion to Psalm 16, by the way. With the promise of the full restoration of his created order forever, all to the praise of the glory of his grace. And that's from Ephesians 1, which gets repeated 3 times to give us God's ultimate reason for doing what he does, namely to the praise of the glory of his grace. So there's a definition that I find helpful. I know it's long, and there's lots of pieces to it, but I find it helpful. So if you take that with you and just remember kind of the main contours of it, doesn't have to be word for word, but this is a good starting place to share with someone that then helps them, okay, tell me more. And then you just, as you have opportunity, you tell more. So that's the meaning of the gospel. Why is it so important? Well, we've already kind of answered it, so I'll just go through this quickly. Apart from it, there is no salvation. There's only condemnation. You see this from a variety of texts. John 3 16, we all know, God loved the world and gave his only son, that whoever would believe would not perish but have everlasting life. A couple of verses later, however, it says in chapter 3, for those who don't believe, the wrath of God remains on them. So, without the gospel, there is no salvation, only condemnation. Therefore, the gospel must be understood clearly, it must be communicated, and it must be preserved. Distortions of the gospel belittle Christ and destroy the soul. Those are the implications. That's why I've spent so much time trying to get us clear on what the gospel is. Paul in Galatians is furious at this issue. He says, how can you be turning to another gospel? Not that there is another one. There's only one. But there are some who want to, he says, distort the gospel. So don't turn away from the true gospel. It's belittling to Christ and it destroys the soul. So as a reminder, what's our aim? What are we focused on this summer? To inspire and equip one another for greater participation and effectiveness in local personal evangelism. So some recommended resources, I've mentioned some of them already. This one's available to buy. It's Matt Smethurst, Before You Share Your Faith, 5 Ways to Be Evangelism Ready. That one's out here and available today. It's a great little book. It says $5 on it, but I actually think Will was telling me it's 3-something today. That's what it rang up as. So for $3, yes, this is a must. So go ahead and grab that. Greg Gilbert's book, What is the Gospel? We'll have this in coming weeks. It just didn't come in yet. This is that systematic approach that I went through. And then John Piper's book, God is the Gospel, is another great one. It'll be available. He agrees with all of that systematic stuff, but he presses that if we don't understand God as the ultimate good himself enjoyed in the gospel, then we've truncated the gospel. So that's an important book. Michael Reeves is one I didn't mention, but this is a new book put out by Crossway. I think we have a few copies of this here as well today. A Call for Evangelical Integrity. It's Gospel People. This gets into defining the gospel more broadly, holistically, very helpful, especially with respect to answering the question, what is an evangelical? Someone who embraces the gospel, what is that? That's this book. And then I mentioned Don Carson's work, which is spectacular, but it's actually found, fortunately, if you like big books, unfortunately, if you don't, in a bigger book. It's called For the Fame of God's Name. This is Essays in Honor of John Piper put together. It's a collection of essays, but Don Carson writes his article in here, What is the Gospel Revisited? That's where I got some of his work from. It's very good, and I would commend that to you as well. This will be here in coming weeks also. So, we just have a couple minutes for some Q&A, but I'm happy to take any questions that you might have in light of what we've looked at, and we'll have a microphone. Josue, I think you've got the microphone. He can pass it around because we are recording these sessions, and that way the question can be clearly heard. So are there any questions at this point? Yeah, David has a question.
Hey, thanks. I would just be curious to hear if you have any practical takeaways for kind of that like on-the-ground 30-second evangelism, especially when it seemed like you were critiquing some of the narrative-type approaches of the gospel that it seems like that's based on, of if our understanding of the narratival approach that you presented is like not exactly the way that I traditionally think of it, kind of in especially like at school, like my crew friends taught me, like these are the ways that I share the gospel. If we critique that view of the gospel, any, is there a takeaway then for how I present the gospel in 30 seconds that is a more effective presentation of the gospel, or is it primarily it was a critique of like our theological understanding of the gospel itself?
Yeah, so I'm not necessarily even critiquing the narratival approach other than to say if we speak at the story level without getting to what Paul and I would call the heart of the gospel, the center of it, which is the work of Christ on behalf of sinners. So you can tell the kind of broad story of the gospel without going there. That's the critique. So it's not don't tell that big story. Certainly do. Can you do that in 30 seconds? No, not the totality of it. But can you in 30 seconds talk about how Jesus is actually the fulfillment of a long promise of God that we read about in the Old Testament? Sure. And then get right to the heart of his crucifixion and resurrection and then our response of trust in him that removes, you know, our condemnation and sets us right with God, et cetera, et cetera. So in the coming weeks, by the way, there will be certain weeks that are much more practically oriented or leaning, and some weeks that are more theoretical leaning. This one happens to be a more theoretically leaning Sunday, but we will have opportunity to think deeper with one another about practically, how do I do this with somebody? And I'm excited for some of that as well. When we get into, you know, the manner and the means of effective witness in the coming next 2 weeks, we'll address some of that head on. So that's a good question. Other questions? Yeah. We got one in the back, and then we'll have one up front here, Josue.
I actually have two. Could you do a word study definition for me of teleological?
I think
you mentioned
telos. It comes from the Greek word telos, which means goal or purpose. And the teleology, the ology part, just means study of. So study of a purpose. Okay. What is something's purpose? And so when Piper makes the claim that God himself is the gospel, he's only referring to that with respect to the gospel's ultimate purpose. It is to justify sinners. It is to have forgiveness of sins, all that. Those are all wonderful promises and gifts. But somebody could theoretically say, oh, that sounds good to me, but you know, knowing God or having fellowship with him, that kind of sounds, I don't need that. He would say, then you haven't really understood the full gospel.
And maybe the second question is related to that. I found myself wondering if it's really good news for the hearer, why is there so much resistance to it from some people?
Yeah, the sinful heart would be one answer. We, in general, as humans, don't like to be told that we are dependent and not independent, that we are accountable to a living God and thus not free to live life however we please. Especially in our current cultural context, those are pretty like strong blows across the bow of our kind of human tendencies. So remember that good news only sounds good to a hearer if they have been persuaded that they are in a condition that needs it. For many, they're not persuaded at that level at all. And so it just sounds like an interesting message. Oh, that's interesting. That's good for you. Oh, wonderful. You know, I'll just do my own thing. So I think that's part of the answer. There's probably more to say there, but question up front.
Thank you for this. I think you did a really good job. Organization of your talk, you spoke with clarity. It was well-researched. I thought it was really awesome. I agreed with, like, everything. I say that because I'm
about to pick
on you on one point.
Yeah, that's okay. That's okay.
Can you comment on the non-inclusion of Jesus as the Son of God in your gospel message or reference to his divinity? You talk about his perfect life, but we don't mention that he's the Son of God. And I just want to hear your reasoning behind that.
That would be a good thing to include. There would be lots of things I would include in this definition. I think, what else could I say to that question? When I say the words everlasting joy in his presence, I mean to identify the God of Psalm 16 with Jesus. So implicitly, it's there in the definition, and to explain it and talk with someone would become explicit very quickly. Especially if I'm talking with Muslims whose main trip up is on the sonship, the eternal sonship, the deity of Christ. And so you have to go there. Who is this Jesus Christ who lived a perfect life, and how did he do that? No one else in history has done that. Well, because he's both like us and utterly not like us is where that would go. So I completely agree with you. Maybe I should put that in there as a just another comma phrase. The good news that God, through the perfect life, atoning death, and bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ, his son, you could just put in those words. That would be perfectly fine. I do not intend to diminish that at all, and I think I would get there with unpacking some of those phrases in due course with somebody. But good question. Well, we have one more. Okay, final question here, because it is...
It's more like a tiny comment.
Oh, tiny comment. That's okay. Yeah. We take
Scott
those two.
Scott McKnight, I think, has some really inspirational way of thinking about reaching out to people in certain ways, too. I know he's had a lot of his students come to faith. And
who is this? I missed the
Scott
first...
Scott McKnight.
Oh, Scott McKnight.
Yeah, you know, like listening to his podcast or being
right.
reading.
Yeah.
And he would just say, I would just tell them about Jesus.
Right.
And they would fall in love with Jesus. And so I think...
Well, and that's part of his...
That's a lot of his perspective.
That's part of his narratival approach, because I didn't have time to get into all of it, but part of the story of Jesus is actually like, what did he do for 30 years? Or maybe more specifically, 3 years of his actual earthly ministry. So he's concerned with helping people attach the story of Jesus in the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, with the climax of his life, and which is his death and resurrection. And so part of that narrative is, who was Jesus? Who was this person? What did he do? And in his experience, the recounting of a lot of those things for students does compel them to Jesus in ways that perhaps the kind of more systematic or abstracted version had not, for whatever reason, in their previous years. So, yeah, good comment. Well, thanks, everybody. That is it for this morning. We're out of time. We'll see you next week when we get into the manner of effective witness. What should be our tone when we talk with people? How should we carry ourselves, etc.? That's next week. So, we'll see you. God bless.